We'll believe in freedom. Hear me talking to you. We'll believe in freedom. And not a risk until the killing of black men, black mothers, sons, is as important as the killing of white men. White mothers, sons, do you believe in freedom? And not freedom, and not a rest. Sing it with me if you like it. We who believe in freedom. Older I get, the better I know that the secret of my going on is when the reins are in the hands of the young who dare to run against the storm. Cause to me, young people come first. They have the courage where we fail. And if I can but shed some light, I may carry us through the gales. We who believe in freedom and our rest, hear me talking to ya. We who believe in freedom and our rest, come tell ya. Been struggling myself, don't need a whole lot. I've come to realize that teaching others to stand up and fight is the only way my struggle survives. I'm a woman who speaks in a voice, and I must be heard. At times I can be quite difficult.
Good afternoon, this is Zain El-Amin with the Shayunana Show, and today we are obviously celebrating Juneteenth, and I wanted to talk about several things at length relating to this auspicious day, that just in tying what is happening in Palestine right now to the issue of civil rights in the United States. And also, it just so happens to be a day when Hunter Biden is facing a 25-year sentence, which he will not serve a day of it, I guarantee you. And the reason why I mentioned this is because on this day, what we're talking about is Joe Biden, the architect of the crime bill, which, as I've been mentioning, and that's been my mantra for the last few shows, because the hypocrisy is glaring, especially when Palestine is becoming the litmus test for global justice and for civil rights here. Whatever happens to the Palestinians, whatever is allowable, whatever Biden's supporters that shout four more years are supporting at this moment, will be acceptable to happen to any person of color, and especially to African Americans in here. The hypocrisy today is that Hunter Biden is facing charges of buying a gun when he was under the influence of drugs, basically, and using drugs as an excuse, basically, that he wasn't fully capable to comprehend what he was doing. This is the same excuse that he used previously when talking about his financial illegal financial movements, especially like in threatening international entities that his father will do them economic harm if they don't comply with his own interests. So here we have the son of the creator, or the son of one of the initiators of the crime bill, you know, on Juneteenth, basically saying that he should be forgiven, when his father, when he championed this crime bill, he said that anybody dealing with drugs, and obviously who got nailed for it is black people and people of color, not white rich kids like Hunter Biden. But he said these people are irredeemable. Basically, that's what Biden said in his speeches again and again, and painted them as predators, and that it shouldn't be forgiven or given second chances, which his son will be given second and third chances in this. So it's important to point out this hypocrisy, this attack on civil rights, this attack on black people that Biden had initiated and that Republicans are building on, because we're given this false information that he is the person, you know, he's the kinder, gentler option, but they're both, one is demented, one is mad. Those are the choices we have right now. Having said that, I want to mention several things also that are being sort of swept under the rug, so to speak. One is that there's a strong tradition in civil rights that should be mentioned on Juneteenth, in the civil rights movement, in terms of in its inextricable relationship with the Palestinian liberation and with the liberation of any people that are being colonized. And the voices of Baldwin, James Baldwin, and Malcolm X are the strongest in that sense in connecting those two things. And right now, James Baldwin's legacy is being whitewashed, and we'll listen to a clip of what is happening in terms of how they're whitewashing Baldwin's legacy. this upcoming film, they're trying to remove any mention of what he said about Palestine and liberation, which is really important and key. And he didn't mince words when he talked about these things. So we'll talk about that. But what Baldwin, just to, you know, one of his many quotes or many declarations about Palestine goes as follows. But the state of Israel was not created for the salvation of Jews. It was created for the salvation of the Western interests. This is what is becoming clear. I must say that it was always clear to me. The Palestinians have been paying for British colonial policy of divide and rule and for Europe's guilty Christian conscience for more than 30 years. What Malcolm X had to say, he said many things about Palestine. Of course, he stood steadfast along with Muhammad Ali Clay. Muhammad Ali Clay actually visited refugee camps in Palestine. He said he supported Palestinian liberation. But I wanted to give you a summary, a short summary of what is what Malcolm X's history is with the Palestinian issue, and especially with liberation of most Arab nations. So starting with Malcolm X, in terms of his encounter with the historical figure, not his physical encounter, but his encounter with Salah ad-Din al-Ayyubi, who liberated Jerusalem. In an interview with Egyptian periodical Minbar al-Islam in 1964, Malcolm said that from his days as a young man in prison, he had understood Islam as a leading force in the fight against Western imperialism. As an example, he mentioned the liberator of Palestine from Crusaders occupation, Salah ad-Din, in 1193, as an example of Muslim strength and dignity, as he described it, strength and dignity. Malcolm joined the Nation of Islam while in prison, and in the Nation of Islam, he met Palestinians like Jamil Shakir Diab, principal and instructor of Arabic at Nation of Islam's University of Islam in Chicago, and Ali Baghdadi, who wrote for the Nation of Islam's influential newspaper at the time, Muhammad Speaks. Malcolm X's relationship with Jerusalem in the Nation of Islam. Malcolm also worked with Iraq's Muhammad Taqi Mehdi. They put together the Third Pakistan Republic Day Conference in Hollywood, in California, on April 7th, 1958. Here, Malcolm, for the first time, openly spoke for Palestine, affirming ties with Black people in the U.S. and, quote, Arabs as colored people, close quote. He criticized the, quote, aggressive Zionists, close quote, and the U.S. government for, quote, subsidizing, close quote, Israel. In 1959, at the invasion of Egypt's President at the invitation of Egypt's President Gamal Abdel Nasser to the Nation of Islam, Malcolm visited Egypt and also made a brief visit to Jordanian-controlled East Jerusalem. Sadly, there isn't much known about this visit. And about Malcolm X's relationship to Gaza, in 1964, Malcolm left the Nation of Islam, embraced Islam, and performed Hajj, which is the pilgrimage to Mecca, as some of you know. At his hotel in Jeddah, he met and spoke with prominent Palestinian political/religious leader Amin al-Husseini. He also spoke at University in Beirut, at a university in Beirut where many Palestinians studied, and at the summit of Organization for African Unity in Cairo, where he noted that many African-American leaders for the first time denounced Israel and supported Palestinian right of return. Then on September 4th, 1964, he headed to Gaza in an Egyptian government car crossing the Suez Canal and the Sinai before arriving in Khan Yunis. That is, of course, as you know now, in Gaza. And Malcolm X actually stayed and prayed in Gaza. This is what is known. Malcolm checked into the Kuwaiti hotel on the Mediterranean Sea. Gaza was under Egyptian control, and the Egyptians had made it a duty-free zone. Many products were available in Gaza that could not be obtained anywhere else in Egypt, so Malcolm went shopping. The next day, he met local leaders, visited refugee camps, a hospital, and the area of the ceasefire line with Israel. Later on, he met with poet Harun Hashim Rashid, a survivor of Israel's massacre in Khan Yunis of in 1956. Malcolm then prayed Isha at the masjid in Gaza, noting in his diary that the spirit of Allah was strong, and then held a press conference where he was given many gifts. Malcolm X met with Palestinian imams. Harun H. Rashid noted in his memoirs that Malcolm, quote, came to Gaza with a strong desire to learn about the Palestinian cause. He was a true Muslim who shed tears many times as he heard about the tragedies of Palestinians. He was a humanist and Muslim in essence. That's how Harun described him. Rashid said that everyone who met Malcolm in Gaza loved him, including Islamic scholar and chief judge Muhammad Khulusi Psisu, who was impressed by Malcolm's knowledge, tact, and humility. Psisu reportedly insisted on personally taking Malcolm to the airport in Arish. As Malcolm climbed the stairs to board the plane, he turned back and waved and chanted, quote, "We shall return, we shall return," close quote. Malcolm X was also inspired by a poet in Gaza, and that's important to point out as they've killed many poets in Gaza recently. And this shows how things haven't changed. These things existed before October 7th. So where did Malcolm pick up this chant, "We shall return"? In his diary, he had copied some moving lines by the Palestinian poet he met in Gaza, Harun Hashim Rashid. And the poem goes like this: "We must return. No boundaries should exist. No obstacles can stop us. Cry out, refugees, we shall return. Tell the mountains, we shall return. Tell the alley, we shall return. We are going back to our youth. Palestine calls us to arm ourselves, and we are armed and are going to fight. We must return." Rashid left a deep impression on him, obviously. Malcolm X publishes what's called the Zionist logic also. Malcolm returned to Cairo after a two-day visit to Gaza. There he met Ahmed Sukairi, president of the newly founded Palestinian Liberation Organization at the time. On September 17, 1964, Malcolm's essay, Zionist Logic, came out in an Egyptian gazette. He may have written it at the request of Egypt's president, Jamal Abdel Nasser. He wrote, "Did the Zionists have the legal or moral right to invade Arab Palestine, uproot its Arab citizens from their homes and seize all Arab property for themselves just based on the religious claim that their forefathers lived there thousands of years ago. Lastly, in summary, Malcolm talking about Israel in general, Malcolm referred to Zionism as a new form of colonialism that was well disguised and appeared to be, quote, more benevolent, more philanthropic, close quote. He ended his essay thus, quote, in short, the Zionist argument to justify Israel's present occupation of Arab Palestine has no intelligent or legal basis in history, not even in their own religion, close quote. Of course, we're finding out that this kind of right of occupation has its religious basis, but it doesn't even exist in Judaism, as we were finding out from scholars of Judaism and the scholars of Torah. So in an interview noting that the U.S. financially supported Israel while depriving Americans, and especially Black Americans, Malcolm said, quote, Israel is just an international poorhouse which is maintained by money sucked from poor suckers in America, close quote. And of course, we know now that we see the deprivation of urban centers. Every urban center where there's significant populations of Black people and people of color, whether it's Chicago or DC or New York, we have this issue where there is a robbing of from domestic support, and so we have places like Flint that doesn't even have clean water. We have a country, the United States, that doesn't have universal health care while it's subsidizing universal health care in Saudi Arabia. That's what Malcolm the visionary had, you know, well, that's why he said that particularly. And of course, money is being dumped blindly and recklessly into military, into the military industrial complex. Malcolm, the summary ends with the statement that Malcolm, a trailblazing, influential advocate of Palestine, was assassinated in 1965, as we all know. So that's what people that we respect, like James Baldwin, like Malcolm X, that never minced words when it came to justice, had said about this. And also, like, this is important to say because, of course, James Baldwin was a gay man that, of course, championed gay rights merely by his works, and that we have Pride Month, which is being pinkwashed right now. And that's why I played the earlier bit about James Baldwin. It's important to point these things out on Juneteenth and during Pride Month, that we should not let James Baldwin's legacy, and we should not censor him, and we should not let the director and writer that's then the star of this new biopic do the whitewashing and the pinkwashing of that legacy. So we're going to have a listen to several things. First of all, that relate to this. One, we're going to talk about what Joe Biden is. This is something I played before. What Joe Biden's complicity in the crime bill, which if a black man, according to that crime bill, was on trial for what Hunter Biden is being on trial for, not just as Hunter Biden using illegal drugs, but also his financial mishaps and his also the fact that he used you know, his father's name in his financial transactions, and lastly, buying a gun and using the fact that he was a drug user as you know, that he wasn't making the right decisions. Black people and people of color didn't have a chance with the crime bill for those kinds of crimes. And yet Hunter Biden will give every chance. This is the hypocrisy and this is the racism that Biden had established back in the days where the Democratic Party had full control of the government and was passing reactionary legislation, such as the crime bill, such as the immigration bill, such as the Defense of Marriage Act, which should be mentioned now during Pride. So we'll have a listen to that, and then we'll have a little commemoration of, you know, in terms of Black Lives Matter and remembering George Floyd. And the last thing I wanted to say in remembering George Floyd, I want you to remember that with these demonstrations that happened, you know, when the Black Lives Matter was organizing, that in these demonstrations that we had, that's where the bond between the liberation of Black people in the United States and the liberation of Palestinians connected, because Palestinians and Black activists were in conversation talking about a joint enemy, and that is the police, for example, in Atlanta and in other places, everywhere, and the IDF, or what we call the Israeli offensive forces, that they were in collaboration in attacking these protests. They had joint trainings and such, and the activists were collaborating with each other, even with Palestinians giving tips to activists for Black Lives Matter about how to deal with tear gas, which is the same tear gas that was produced in the United States that was being used both on the ground against Palestinians and both used against Black people. There's a poetic charge there that it's the same tear gas, the same tears, the same tear causing poison was being used for these tragic events. And lastly, we'll talk about why economically this project of this colonial project of Israel cannot last and give real material evidence. I'll play the first part of that, but I urge you to also listen to it on Electronic Intifada.
Very often, Juneteenth is presented as a story of news of the Emancipation Proclamation traveling slowly to the Deep South in Texas. But it was really a story of power traveling slowly and of freedom being seized. On Wednesday, June 19th, WPFW presents Emancipated Spirits, Slavery, Freedom, and Resistance from 5 a.m. until midnight. Through discussions, music, and spoken word, we will interrogate the history of that day, the true meaning of freedom, and the role resistance continues to play in securing liberation. That's Emancipated Spirits, Slavery, Freedom, and Resistance, Wednesday, June 19th, 5 a.m. until midnight, on WPFW, Building a Better World, one broadcast at a time.
For Pride Month, I have one ask for everyone out there, and it's the fact that a Zionist Billy Porter is making a biopic about James Baldwin. For those that don't know, last year, the actress from Pose, Billy Porter, announced that he would co-write, lead act in, and co-produce a forthcoming biopic about the famed writer James Baldwin. And I've posted a lot about this, but I feel the need to post about it again because it's Pride Month. There's a petition out there on change.org. It's in the link in my bio. So far, it has roughly 2,800 signatures. The goal right now is to get that petition to 5,000. I believe we can do that by the end of the month. As we're seeing in Gaza, Rafah is being encroached on. More tents and refugee placements are being bombed. The Israeli government is fiddling around with these ceasefire notions with Biden. Billy Porter has done interviews saying he doesn't care about that terrorist stuff over there. This biopic doesn't need to include James Baldwin's thoughts on the Middle East or on Palestine or on colonization. It just matters that it's about their civil rights movement. And what I think especially Black queer people should be doing is railing against this biopic, speaking out in support of Palestine. Our identities do not deserve to be in service of genocide. So the ways that you can help is by sharing, commenting, and liking. Tag Billy Porter, tag Byron Allen, tag Allen Media Group, and also go to the link in my bio and sign that petition and share it with as many people as possible. Because I think this Pride Month
is also a philosopher who has something to say. I know that you want to hear what he has to say tonight. And it is a deep privilege and an honor to present to you Mr. James Baldwin.
Now?
Yeah.
Okay. I'm very proud to be here tonight. And before I say anything at all, I want to say that I'm very proud of all those marvelous people who preceded me. I mean, the choir and and those actors. And a whole lot of other people who are mainly invisible. But I love them all. Now, I'm going to try to... I'm going to try to be as honest as I can. And I'm going to ask you to bear with me. And let's try to make a certain journey together. We know in what context we're all here and for what reason. In our various ways, we know what terrible trouble we are in. But let us pretend for the moment that it is possible to drop out of the mind labels and slogans. Let us pretend that we can get beneath and beyond the phrase civil rights to what we are really concerned with. Let us consider a life, which begins in fluid and in darkness. Everybody's life begins there. And according to mysteries which we do not understand, is nourished for a certain amount of time and then abruptly hits the terrifying air. This life opens its eyes not really on the world, but on its mother and its father, which it is compelled to trust, since it is helpless. Through its mother and its father, it begins to discover such details as oranges, such details as hunger, such details as panic, such details as loneliness. By and by, this life realizes that in fact it is trapped between a silent heaven and an extremely bloody earth, and has somehow, in order to maintain itself, begin to define the world around it. That world has already, in some sense, been defined by what his mother and his father believe, and what his mother and father have told him, and what his mother and father endure. The child knows, for example, before he knows it, and long before he can say it, what has happened to his father at work that day. The child knows, and he doesn't tell his mother or his father that he knows, when his father is ashamed of himself. The child knows why his mother looks that way on payday, and knows what those strangers, sometimes called welfare workers, sometimes called teachers, sometimes called cops, are doing in his house, what they are doing to his mother and his father, and what they are doing to him. Now, a child's technique is silence. I mean, I know the children rant and rave and scream and throw tantrums, but essentially his technique is silence. When he's really discovering something, when he is really hurt, when it really matters, you got to coax it out of the child. If you love the child, if you're not too ashamed of yourself, and if you have the time. Now, the child we're considering is every child, every life. But this particular child is also, let us say, at this moment, a black child. And one of the things that is happening to him, though he does not know it, cannot say it, is that the world in which he finds himself, and in which he is trying to become defined, and which he is trying to control by naming things, that is all the word noun means. One tries to control the life around you by telling yourself what it is. So if you know that it's an apple or a chair, you think you know something about it. It's better than having no name at all. This child in this republic looks around him one fine day and discovers no reflection of himself whatever. As far as the world in which he finds himself is concerned, he does not exist. He is not to be found in the books, except with a bone between his nose. He is not to be found until this very moment in any history of America. He is not to be found on the stage, insofar as we have one. He is not to be found in the movies, unless he's afraid of ghosts. He is not to be found on television, unless he's pretty pale. Now, this is no stage joke, I'm telling you. You must consider what happens to a life which finds no mirror. You must ask yourself about your own life and how and by what means did you arrive at whatever identity you now think you have. And ask yourself whether or not it is true that we, all of us, take our estimate of ourselves from the eyes of other people. So that love becomes a very serious matter. It is by no means a mystical statement to say that love is all that can save you. I know that in this country and in this age, these sound like the ravings of a madman. But in fact, if you check it out yourself, try to deal with this life I've been trying to convey to you very, very sketchily. By the time it is 16, and has already turned away from any belief in other human beings, any trust at all, ask yourself why this life, so soon, is putting down the world, carrying knives and guns, and what yeoman labor one has got to be willing to do to reach this human being. My point is, one of my points is, that when a society does this, to a sufficient degree, the society is committing suicide. If you'll bear with me another minute, I will ask you to consider, I'm asking you to consider in your own lives. This is not an abstraction. At the moment, this is not even a civil rights rally. Consider what happens to the unloved. Consider what would have happened to you when the chips are down and we find ourselves without all these masks and all these clothes and all these pretensions and all these attitudes down there in the dark where everybody lives. And whatever got you out of it, if you got out of it. If this proposition or if this suspicion is correct, that is, if I am right in assuming that those who are unloved cannot live and cannot grow, let us, by that tentative light, consider the state of this nation. I am not very old, and I have not seen very much, but I have seen one thing. On the block that I was born, which is still there, where most of us perished, there was one great difference just the same between that sordid block in Harlem and the rest of New York City, to say nothing of the country. And the difference may sound mystical, but it was this. If a girl had a baby and she wasn't married, she wasn't stoned to death, and we took care of the baby. The morals didn't matter, especially the morals of this country, which doesn't believe in them and doesn't live by them. But she mattered, the girl mattered, and the baby mattered. It is intolerable to me to imagine for one moment that I would exchange that standard for the standards of this republic. It is inconceivable that anyone who wanted to live would try to live the way most white Americans live. This is, and I am speaking as a part of the country, and a country which I love, or I would not be here. Of all the places I have ever been, of all the things that I've ever seen, this country is in so many ways the most despairing and above all, the most unloved. I don't mean unloved by other people. I'm not talking about Vietnam. I'm talking about the people who live in it, who do not love it enough to take care of it. You have to have a cataclysm in New York for people to speak to each other. And if there's anything rarer than real friendship between Americans, I would have a hard time naming it. Now, I know this sounds excessive, and I know you are thinking he is putting me on. But believe me, if we were, as I hope one day we will be, a civilized nation, name only one event, because there are so many. The acquittal of those people in Mississippi, whom the entire world knows to be guilty. That farce, that impertinence, that obscenity should have sent millions of Americans into the streets. By what right does the governor of that state and its principal representative and J. Edgar Hoover, by what right do they insult us in so intolerable a way? And what is the wrong with this sovereign people who allow the government to say we can do nothing about it? It is late in the day for a country in which I have bled and died for nearly 400 years, in which I have been maligned perpetually until this very moment. And a marvelous question, what does the Negro want? It is late in the day for this country to pretend that I am not a part of it, and it is entirely indefensible that the government which can make me pay my taxes and put me in the army and save the Vietnamese, say nothing of the Cubans, can be able to state things to me later. those men in Mississippi, and I'm speaking only of one event, killed three human beings. They killed them for nothing. For nothing. With our sanction and in our name. No one can tell me that we can do nothing about it. We've let chaos ride unchecked here. We made ignorance and youth the only virtues. It is a great American crime to be complex or double-minded. In fact, it is a great American crime to have any aspirations toward growing up. And with this peculiar arsenal, that is our virtue, our ignorance, and our youth, we pretend to be able to conquer the world. Mexican kids of 10 already know far more about life than Eisenhower ever learned. I realized one thing. Well, I realized a few things, but I realized above all one thing when I was living in Europe, which parenthetically I may say, I was driven to because I could not live here. I realized that the French and the English even, God bless them, and the Italians and the Spanish, the people with whom I dealt, the Algerians and the Africans, they didn't dislike Americans on sight. They were perfectly willing to deal with them man to man. But there was one fatal difficulty. They couldn't find the man. And I realized that those jokers wandering around Europe in their innocence, and there's something beautiful about it, you know, but it has to end. They were resented not because they were cruel, not because they couldn't speak the language, not even because they made the extraordinary assumption that if you spoke louder, everyone would understand you. They began to be hated for a very simple reason, and we haven't learned it yet. They began to be hated because they did not know. They had no way of knowing that what they were facing was a man like them. They had no way of knowing this cat also bled. They had no way of knowing that the man they were talking to, the woman they were talking to, was a human being. She was not simply like a whore. He was not simply like a bum. He was not simply like a writer. She wasn't simply just an actress. They had a long tale to tell. And the Americans couldn't hear it, couldn't see it, didn't know it. Above all, didn't know it. And what they didn't know about them, what we, the Americans, don't know about the world, I suddenly realized is what Americans don't know about me. We have paid, and we are paying. I think probably the most terrifying price in history
for pretending that a man is not a man. Because by now, really, the entire country believes it. They really don't know why Negroes go to jail. They really don't know why they lay down on airports and tie themselves to cranes. They don't know that I'm not trying to get into a white neighborhood. I'm only trying to live. But they don't know that. It'll be one thing, really, if they knew it and denied it. We've been now so brainwashed. It demands so much nervous energy in the loins, in the heart, in the guts to shake a Negro's hand. One, I really, literally been through this. They walk away mopping their brows. Wow! And then they want a medal. I'm not kidding. This is sad, ladies and gentlemen, this is sad. It is not the Negro in this country. There are not many of us here, really, you know. We're roughly one-tenth of the nation. We have suffered a long time. We've bled a long, long time. Some cat in the Congo, you know, said, I think I'm quoting right, too. We are now very upset about the massacre in the Congo. All of a sudden. I think I'm quoting him right. He said, blood gushing from a heart you love. Have you ever seen that? And I thought, and I think I'm a pretty good Christian. I thought, are you kidding? Blood gushing from a heart I loved? Are you just finding out what that feels like? We've endured it a very long time. A very long time. We have paid our dues. Ladies and gentlemen, we have paid our dues. It is not we. I want to make this very clear. As clear as I can. And do remember we're talking about a life. And remember that I said that before I repudiate the standards by which I grew up, which meant that the baby and the mother were more important than the morals, and live by the standards of this country, I would rather die. It is not we, the American Negro, who is to be saved here. It is you, the American Republic, and you ain't got much time. Thank you.
There's one aspect of George Floyd's death that we aren't allowed to talk about. We could say that George Floyd deserved to be safe, that he should be alive today. We could say that he was murdered by police. We could maybe even allege that he wasn't murdered. But there is a third rail that we can't talk about, which makes me want to talk about it.
Very often, Juneteenth is presented as a story of news of the Emancipation Proclamation traveling slowly to the Deep South in Texas. But it was really a story of power traveling slowly and of freedom being seized. On Wednesday, June 19th, WPFW presents Emancipated Spirits, Slavery, Freedom, and Resistance from 5 a.m. until midnight. Through discussions, music, and spoken word, we will interrogate the history of that day, the true meaning of freedom, and the role resistance continues to play in securing liberation. That's Emancipated Spirits, Slavery, Freedom, and Resistance, Wednesday, June 19th, 5 a.m. until midnight, on WPFW, Building a Better World, one broadcast at a time.
This is movement time, and when it's movement time, we can all be together.
Reverend Dr. William Barber.
We are here to announce that on June the 29th at 10 o'clock on Pennsylvania and 3rd, we are calling for the mass Poor People's Low Wage Workers Assembly and Moral March on Washington and to the polls.